Hello and welcome to Sense and Sensibility, the Inflation Guy podcast. I am the Inflation Guy. I am Michael Ashton, your host. And today on the podcast, you know, this is not an interview show. And so sometimes we take on topics that are more complex, and I try to make them simple. But this is an example of something that, which is a little bit more complex. I'm going to explain the foreign exchange interpretation of inflation, and sort of how that, you know, impacts the way we look at and price financial instruments. And then I'm going to directly tie that to the persistent mistakes that observers have made in this current cycle in terms of thinking about home prices. And it's a little bit of a complex subject, but I hopefully this will make sense to you, and you should not be afraid. I'll be very gentle. But first, a word from our sponsors. This episode of Sense and Sensibility is sponsored by Simplify ETFs, a fast-growing ETF shop democratizing access to the most sophisticated alternative strategies. With diversifying strategies like market neutral, equity long, short, managed futures, and multi-strat quant, Simplify has a suite of compelling tools to help address the biggest concerns with the classic 60-40 portfolio. Check out their website at simplify.us. That's simplify.us, and you can find their entire lineup of ETFs at simplify.us/ETFs. This podcast is also sponsored by Enduring Investments. Inflation is looking like it's going to be sticky and not like it was before, which means that portfolio dynamics will be different going forward since the inflation factor is abroad in the land again. This affects you, whether you're an individual investor or a pension or an insurance company or a wealth management CIO. And if you're looking for a manager for your personal money or a sub-advisor or a consultant for your corporate treasury or fund, look to Enduring to help you navigate these new portfolio dynamics. Defend your money. Visit enduringinvestments.com. You know, we live in a nominal world. That's no surprise to anybody, but everything is priced in today's dollars. Okay, that's because we live in today. Everything is priced in today's money in most countries, although there is an exception that I'm going to mention in a bit. And so we grow up in that world. And all of our corporate finance, you know, net present value analysis, et cetera, are done in terms of today's dollars. Sometimes, like when you're running an NPV, a net present value analysis, you know, you might have some assumed inflation rate incorporated in, but that's just sort of speculative. If you get a savings or retirement analysis from some big firm, they'll usually show you how many dollars you'll accumulate, you know, based on, you know, equity returns being 7% per year for X number of years or whatever. But obviously that's not very useful information, since that 7% depends on what inflation is. 7% if inflation was 34% would not be very good. And the value in terms of what you can buy in X years with that pile of money, you know, the firm shows you big pile of money, $2 million, you know, in X years. But you have no idea what that's going to buy you. And that's really the only thing you care about is what that pile of money is going to buy you. But shops like to show big numbers, and they like to show you in depreciated dollars in the future rather than in the more valuable dollars today, because it looks like a bigger number and it makes you happier. Now, there are a couple ways to think about how these future values, the values in these what I just called depreciated dollars in the future, they buy less. That's what inflation does. Those dollars buy less. There's a couple ways to think about how those future values and the current values tie together. One way is in nominal space, is to discount that nominal future value by a nominal interest rate. So concretely, if interest rates are at 5%, all right, if a one-year interest rate is 5%, then $105 next year is worth $100 today. So, you know, that doesn't tell you how much that $105 in the future will buy. To know that, you need to know what inflation is going to be over the next year, and there's a lot of risk around that. If you know, you might know that you're going to get $105, maybe it's a tax refund or something. And if there's 0% inflation over that next year, then that $105 in the future is worth the same, buys the same amount as $105 would buy today if you had it. But if there's 100% inflation over that year, then that $105 only buys what $52.50 today would buy. So you can see that that way of tying future values and current values together is deterministic in nominal space. You know exactly the interest rate is 5%. You know exactly how many dollars today it takes to get to 100, you know, how many X dollars today it takes to get Y dollars in the future, right? And it's riskless in the sense that if you buy a 5% one-year treasury bill, you will have 105 nominal dollars in 1 year. And you can, and so you can think about that, of that interest rate as a kind of exchange rate. An exchange rate, now I have to say this, you know, I know I have listeners from around the world, but for U.S. listeners, you know, U.S. listeners are not as familiar with foreign exchange dynamics because, you know, a lot of Americans don't travel overseas very often in ways that they need to use foreign exchange. Whereas if you grew up in Europe, you know, foreign exchange is just something you do, you know, automatically. Maybe not so much anymore with the euro, but when I was younger, you know, if you met somebody from Europe, they could in an instant translate between marks and francs and Swiss francs and lira and whatever. Anyway, so an exchange rate between two currencies, though, for those of you who don't know, it tells you how much of currency A you get for currency B. So if the Mexican peso is trading at an exchange rate of 17 to 1 against the dollar, that means I can buy 17 pesos for $1, or alternatively, I can buy $1 if I have 17 pesos. So that's, it's two-sided. You can go either direction at that exchange rate, and an interest rate is the same thing. If I'm entitled to $105 in 1 year, for example, from a tax refund, then I can turn that $100 that into $100 today by selling a bond that yields, you know, that yields 5%. Ignoring, of course, that my credit isn't the same as the U.S. government. It's probably better, but you know, I can issue a $100 bond. Somebody pays me $100. I have that today, and I pay them $105 in the future. So, and when I pay them $105 in the future, somebody else has given me $105, and so those net, and the net result is I have $100 today. Okay, and if I have $100 today, then I can buy such a bond and have that $105 in 1 year. So again, it's two ways, just like a foreign exchange rate. The bond market is where that exchange happens, and it's all in dollars, so it isn't foreign, and so we don't call it foreign exchange. But it's exactly the same mechanism. The interest rate ties the current and future nominal values together, and so it's an exchange rate. But what we don't know from that is we don't know what that $105 will buy. So I might instead want to ask what the real exchange rate is that will give me inflation-adjusted dollars in the future. Now, obviously, that's just the real interest rate. If that real interest rate, a one-year TIPS bond, is 2%, then my $100 today will give me 102 inflation-adjusted dollars in the future. What is inflation-adjusted dollars? What does that mean? Well, mechanically, we do that by saying, I'll give you $102 in a year, and I'll add to it the actual inflation that happened, the amount that $100 declined in value. So again, I'm exchanging future inflation-adjusted dollars for today's dollars. And that's uncertain in terms of the nominal amount you'll receive. It'll be 102 plus or minus something with whatever inflation is. But it's deterministic in terms of the amount you'll have in inflation-adjusted dollars. And if inflation is a good description of what your costs are doing, then it means you'll be able to buy the same amount 1 year from now as you can today. Or you'll be able to buy 2% more 1 year from now, 2% more stuff than you could today. So that's 102 of today's dollars. You could buy in the future, you'll be able to buy what $102 today would buy. So again, I'm exchanging future inflation-adjusted dollars for today's dollars. And then you can see, of course, that that also sets up the an exchange rate in the future. So we have an exchange rate now between today's dollars and nominal dollars in the future, 105. We have an exchange rate between today's dollars and inflation-adjusted dollars in the future, 102 plus inflation. And that means that we have an exchange rate in the future, a forward exchange rate that says I should be able to exchange 105 nominal dollars in the future for 102 inflation-adjusted dollars in the future. Because if I can't, if that isn't the right, if that's not the right exchange rate in the future, then there's some arbitrage that can happen. So it must be fair if I agree to exchange $102 inflation-adjusted dollars in 1 year for 105 nominal dollars. And that, of course, is the expected or the break-even inflation rate of 3% in this case. Anyway, the insight that this is all just like foreign exchange was verbalized in 2003, or verbalized is maybe not quite correct because it was put into a paper, by Jarrow and Yildirim in a classic paper entitled Pricing Treasury Inflation-Protected Securities and Related Derivatives Using an HJM Model. Link in the show notes if you really want to hurt your head. It's dense and difficult reading. But the insight's pretty simple. The exchange between future nominal dollars and future real dollars is a forward exchange rate, and therefore you can use FX pricing models to value things like inflation options and stuff like that. It turns out to be a little bit more difficult than that in actual practice, but that basic insight is right on, that this is just an exchange rate, and so we can use all the same foreign exchange models, and they work pretty well in this regard. Now, before we get to housing, all this is about exchange rates and the exchange rate analogy for inflation, you might ask, well, why doesn't someone just create a currency that's indexed to inflation? So it's really just like foreign exchange. Well, you are brilliant. And I always tell people that. I have a brilliant audience, and you're good looking too. In fact, back in 1967, Chile, of all places, introduced the Unidad de Fomento, or the UF. You can see in the show notes, I've got a Wikipedia link, but you can just look up the Unidad de Fomento and there's a lot of great information about that. Anyway, it's a currency adjusted for inflation. It doesn't actually trade. It's not an actual physical currency. No one issues UF. But if you're a restaurateur, for example, you can put a UF price on the menu, and then you don't have to change it every day when inflation is high. If these eggs are 2 UF, then it's, you know, you just look up what the exchange rate is between UF, that's the inflation-adjusted currency, and the actual currency that's trading today, and you'll know what the price is in today's dollars. And that means the restaurateur doesn't have to change the price just because inflation changed, just because the price level changed. If you ever travel to a foreign country, then you know how this works. You see the price, you make a mental, you know, on the menu, you make a mental calculation to bring it into the currency you actually use to see what it really costs in terms of what I have in my pocket. UF are actually used, they're just not actually, you know, physically traded. And it's a pity they really haven't caught on more broadly. As a funny aside, you know, I have traveled internationally, and I say you always make this little, you know, calculation in your head, and the funniest example where that was a fail for me was I was driving in France for some reason. At the time, gasoline in the U.S. was about $1 a gallon, and so I drove up and I looked up at the price of gasoline. and it said, you know, one. And I was very excited. So I, you know, I pulled in and I filled up my car with gas, and it was a lot of money. And I realized that that one was, first of all, it was €1, not $1, which at the time was not close to one-to-one, but also it was per liter and not per gallon. So there's a couple of different ways that the exchange rate can get you. So instead of paying $1 a gallon, I was paying more like $5 a gallon to fill up my car with gas. So you have to be a little bit careful about those conversions. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, the point is you can think about the variability of the future price level compared to today as something akin to exchange rate volatility. Now, let me explain why this got people all twisted up in terms of thinking about housing. Imagine that you moved to Japan, unless you're listening in Japan, in which case, imagine you moved somewhere else. And when you got there, you had a whole pile of dollars saved up, and the exchange rate was, say, 100 to 1. So every time you needed yen, you sold dollars and you got 100 yen for each of them. You didn't hold a lot of yen. You just held dollars and you just made the translation. And you'd get pretty quickly, you'd get so that every time you saw a price in yen, you'd just divide by 100. You see a car for 3 million yen and you'd say, okay, that's 30,000 USD. And you'd go and cash out 30K and go buy the car. Now, let's suppose one day the exchange rate just all of a sudden goes to 75 to 1. You see the car for 3 million yen, hasn't changed. It costs them the same amount to make a car. And you think, okay, so that's 30K US. And you go and exchange 30K US. And then you go to the dealer and he says, well, you're about 750,000 yen light because your 30K only got you 2.25 million yen, not 3 million yen. The car's price denominated in yen is unchanged. The car's price denominated in the currency you're actually using to pay went up to 40,000. Okay, so that's what happened to people in inflation. You had a price effect that you were used to when certain things happened, but you're thinking in the old dollars. You need more new dollars to buy everything now than you did because the exchange rate of old dollars to new dollars didn't go from 1 to 101, okay? You know, over a course of a year, 1% inflation means old dollars and new dollars have a 1 to 101 exchange rate. It was 1 to 120. So in 2019 dollars, home prices are only up about 19% since the end of 2019, about 4.5% a year. So not crazy. Given the paucity of supply of homes out there, that's not a crazy number. And in fact, home prices in those terms are flat since the end of 2021. You can look at, you know, there's a link in the show notes to a chart. I'm using the Case-Shiller 10 city index in that chart because you can actually trade the Case-Shiller 10, but that doesn't really matter which index you use. And I've normalized it to the end of 2019. So it's 100 in 2019 and you can see what the current difference. So I hear you asking. So anyway, so that's kind of why people kind of got screwed up a little bit about housing is that they said, okay, you know, we have, you know, we know that when the Fed, you know, tightens a lot and when bad things happen in the economy and all that stuff, we know that home prices plunge. We know that because we saw that in 2008 and 9 and 10. Except that in 8, 9, and 10, we were talking about 1% underlying inflation. The exchange rate wasn't moving very much between current dollars and future dollars. And so when you looked at home prices from year 1 to year 2 to year 3, looking at nominal inflation, just it didn't matter whether you were looking at it in yesterday's dollars or today's dollars. They were kind of the same. But over the last several years, even if nothing happened to home prices, if they were flat, then that would have represented a 20% or so decline in the real value of the home. So home prices didn't have to go down for homes to get cheaper in terms of how they exchange for other stuff. And again, that's something that, you know, for 25 years, we didn't have to worry about making those little translations from year one to year two to year three because price didn't move very much. But we're in an era of much greater inflation volatility and much greater inflation change. And so people got really sort of confused and they said, well, we're going to have this, you know, 10% fall in home prices. Well, we didn't have a 10% fall, but we definitely home prices went up a lot less. Like I said, they're unchanged after inflation from 2021. So, you know, they went from going up rather aggressively. Part of that's because of the end of the eviction moratorium, whatever, but they went up rather aggressively in 2019 and 20, and then in 21, and then went, once the Fed started aggressively tightening, home prices went flat in real terms, but they rose in nominal terms. And that's the part that people, they never had to make that translation between real and nominal. So that's kind of what happened, is that people aren't used to thinking about how the unit over short periods of time changes in value. And now it does. That's the reason that Chile has a unidad de fomento and nobody else, not nobody else, but, you know, but we don't, because we didn't need it. Restaurateurs didn't need to put, you know, a UF price, because the dollar price was pretty much the same next year as it was this year. If it changed, it didn't change very much. So every couple of years, you know, your restaurateur would change the menu, but didn't have to change it very often. When prices are changing a lot, when inflation is higher, they call them menu costs, actually, because you do have to go and redo those things. You have to restrike everything like that. That's part of what foreign exchange volatility does for you. But that's the reason that everybody kind of screwed up housing. And if you listened to us here, you didn't, and you knew that housing prices were not going to decline in any meaningful way, because the underlying price level was just going up so much that in nominal terms, house prices could go flat, and that would mean that they were, in fact, getting quite a bit cheaper. Now, I hear you asking. So, you know, the net effect, of course, is that if the value of the dollar is declining rapidly, then the nominal value of the house is going to go up, right? So it doesn't mean that it's really going up in terms of, you know, in its actual value, but the nominal price is going up because the dollar value is going down. That's the reason that commodities tend to go up when inflation goes high, is that the value of the dollar is what's actually going down. Okay, so I hear you saying, doesn't that same thing apply to stocks? You know, it applies to commodities, it applies to houses. Inflation should be good for equities, right? Well, yes and no. Equity earnings benefit because they are denominated in weaker dollars. Trailing 12-month the S&P 500 earnings from the end of 2019 are up 45.3%. So trailing 12-month S&P 500 earnings since the end of 2019 are up 45%. But they're only up 20% in 2019 dollars. Yeah, there's another link in the show notes. And by the way, isn't it interesting that both homes and earnings are both up about 45% in nominal terms and up about 20% in real terms? Would it surprise you to learn that M2 is also up a bit less than 40% since then? So there's 40% more dollars out there, and the price of homes is up a bit more than 40%. Equity earnings before extraordinary items are also about 40%. Gee, that's so weird. How does that happen? Anyway, earnings are better in quotes here, by 45%, even though we know that's really only 20% in 2019 dollars. But the S&P 500 itself, the index, is up by more, by about 58% since the end of 2019. I'm writing this on March 26th. By the time you listen to this, maybe it'll be up a lot more than that. Who knows? But that's because people are paying more in today's dollars for a dollar of today's earnings than they paid in 2019 for a dollar of 2019 earnings. In other words, the multiple that people are paying has expanded since 2019. Now, in theory, since we're buying dollars of today's earnings with today's dollars, just like we were in 2019, the multiple itself should be independent of the price level. And in fact, Franco Modigliani said that in the early 1980s. He said, you know, that the next phenomenon that I'm about to mention shouldn't actually happen because, you know, it's an illusory phenomenon. If the multiple is independent of the price level, then stocks would go up like houses whenever that exchange rate, today's dollars over 2019 dollars, increased. Or in other words, when the purchasing power of the currency weakened. If it weakened 40%, then stocks would go up 40%, but in today's dollar terms, it wouldn't have moved, right? So over the long run, you'd need to actually have real earnings go up to have an actual gain. Anyway, if that was exactly true in this case, then stocks would be about 8% lower than they are now. And I don't worry too much about the math, but 8% is 1.45 over 1.58 minus 1. So if prices had only gone up 45% instead of 58%, they'd be 8% lower than now. Okay, so that extra 8% is because of this multiple expansion. Now, here's the problem. Historically, sorry, Franco, the multiple has not been independent of inflation. When inflation goes up, the multiple historically has gone down. And that's why stocks are not good inflation hedges over the short to medium term, meaning over a period of years. In this case, initially the multiple contracted, but the multiple has expanded. And that's another one of the, and that's unusual in inflationary times for the multiple to expand. And that's another one of the disturbing signs to me that we're in a bubble mentality, but I digress. When you see people charting what the multiple has done, first of all, they're generally looking at the forward PE, you know, multiple forward earnings, which of course is all made up. They have no idea what earnings next year are going to be. But they'll show that it's, you know, it's not ridiculously out of line. And naturally, they'll just change the denominator. They'll change, you know, what they think next year's earnings are going to be. But, you know, to make that number fall into line. But again, if I think earnings next year are going to be up 8%, but I also thought inflation was going to be up 8%, then that's not the same as if I thought our earnings were going to be up 8% and inflation's only up 2%, right? So looking at forward PE is also sort of assuming something about the rate of inflation, quite apart from what the multiple itself looks like. But the point is that if the multiple was sort of unchanged from 2019, that would be surprising, because with inflation higher, you should expect the multiple historically to be lower. Anyway, the important thing to remember is that now, the exchange rate between last year's dollars and today's dollars is not the steady 1.02 that it has been for years. 25 years, core inflation was around 2%, plus or minus 0.5%. Now that that's true, now that that exchange rate is not just to say 1.02, two things are true. A, the option on that volatility is worth a lot more, which is to say that assets which protect against inflation should be relatively more valuable because they're protecting against something that is less unlikely. Okay, the inflation option is more likely to go in the money, which is when those inflation protected assets should do better. And two, the second point is that you need to relearn to adjust prices for the actual exchange rate, not the one we were used to. So, you know, we are born into a nominal world. We were brought up in a nominal world. And for the last 25 years prior to COVID, we had pretty much gotten to ignore inflation because over reasonable periods of time, over, you know, a couple of years, inflation was just not important enough to be factored in the calculations. Now it is. And now you have to factor into the calculation and the volatility of it into calculations. That's what economic theorists mean when they say that inflation needs to be low enough to be ignored in everyday transactions. There's nothing magical about a 2% Fed target. It needs to be low enough. People think 2% is low enough, but it needs to be low enough so that it, you know, you don't have restaurateurs having to change their prices all the time, and you don't have people having to sit and calculate, okay, this car is 3% more expensive than it was last year. Wait a minute, but is it really costing me 3% more? No, because inflation is up 7%, so this car is actually cheaper. And inflation needs to be low enough that you don't have to take yourself through that calculation every time you make any sort of transaction, because if you do, it slows down the pace of commerce. Having to adjust is an extra friction. Just ask Europe what the value of removing exchange rate frictions is, or run that in reverse and ask what would happen to European commerce if we broke up the euro and reintroduced individual currencies. What would happen to the pace of commerce? Anyway, that's where we are. And where we are is the end of this episode. So I'm going to say thanks again for tuning into what turned out to be a long episode, but this is a complex topic. And I really appreciate you tuning in. And I'd appreciate it if you like, hit the like button or subscribe, and pass this around to other people. And you can contact me if you have any questions or ideas at inflationguideenduringinvestments.com. I write a blog at inflationguide.blog. I'm on X at @inflation_guy. Obviously, visit our sponsors, and especially Enduring Investments, if you have an inflation challenge. And most importantly of all, defend your money. And if inflation is coming for you, remember, you know a guy.